And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Gioia from San Diego.
Hi, my name is Gioia. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here tonight and to be a part of your meeting. It's an honor and a privilege to share my story and to be a part of AA, sharing with my family, my fellow alcoholics. I'm really nervous. My sobriety date is November 9th of 1999. My sponsor is Karen M., and I have a home group in Pacific Beach. I want to welcome to all the newcomers and everybody here and myself, since it's my first time here. And I really want to say happy birthday to Paul for 4 years, and I really enjoyed the 10-minute speaker. I could relate a lot to – where did the 10-minute speaker go? There you are. I could really relate a lot to your story, and you pretty much summed it up in 10 minutes, the whole deal. So thank you for that. I'm done. No, just kidding. So anyway, I too am from San Diego. I was born and raised in San Diego, and you had mentioned that you did not feel different growing up and you had a normal childhood. I had quite the opposite. I had a very crazy childhood. I did feel different growing up. And I was born in Escondido, and my parents were hippies. And I was born on a plantation slash commune called Earth Station 1. Welcome to the planet Earth. So when I went to school, and all the other little girls and boys were talking about, like, what hospital they were born at and stuff, I felt very different. I didn't really know what to say, and I just had this whole different childhood, and it was crazy, and that's just the way it was, and that's not why I'm an alcoholic. If you would have asked me a year ago, I would have said my first drunk was at age 12, but I was speaking with my mother last week, and she reminded me that I actually had a little episode at age 3. We were in Big Sur. I was 3 years old, and I guess I was having a tantrum at the dinner table, and she decided that a little sip of her wine would calm me down, as people did commonly then, and so she gave me a couple sips, which I kind of gulped down, and I think I drank about half the glass of wine, and age 3, I got drunk. And she said that she thought it was going to calm me down, and she said it did the opposite. I was a rowdy drunk from an early age. I guess I just got worse after putting alcohol in my system instead of kind of calming me down. And I didn't have my first drink, my second drink, until I was 12 years old. I remember before I even ever put a drink or a drug into my system that I had this urge for excitement and escape. And I didn't really know what that was about, but I hadn't been introduced to alcohol or drugs yet. So I started doing, you know, like 11, 12, and I started doing things like ditching school and shoplifting and getting in trouble. And I remember for fun, we would ditch school and we would go down to the railroad tracks. And we would, I lived in this, in these condos, and the railroad track was right down in this, canyon. And we would go down there and we would sit on the train track and we would wait as long as we could. Who could, you know, chicken, like who could stay on the longest before jumping off of the track. This is before I ever took a drink or a drug. This is my, this is, you know, alcoholism, you know, before, even before drinking. So we would jump off and roll down the hill and laugh and be like, ha, 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 you know, like that was so fun. And I never really thought that there was a problem with that until I got sober and looked back many years. But, you know, I was doing some things like that. I was getting in trouble. I was getting bad grades. I was acting out. And I was just like a wild child really early. And as soon as I found alcohol, it was like, oh, now here's the solution. And my first drink was Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, which I thought was fantastic. And so I drank, you know, me and my girlfriends got a hold of some Boone's Farm and, you know, split the bottle or drank the bottle. And and I remember that I got drunk. I do remember that drunk, and I remember spinning. And I remember not saying I wasn't going to do it the next day. I remember loving it, and I remember drinking lots of Boone's Farm for about 6 months until I realized there was better stuff out there. So it just kind of went like that for me. It went really hard and really fast from 12 to 22. I basically was 13, 14, 15 in school, and I would do anything you put in front of me. Tell me your name again. Like Will, I had this magic combo, and it was alcohol, pills, and pot, and that was like the magic carpet ride. I was like, you know, that was like, I was good if I had all three of those, and it was always alcohol. But I did do some really heavy stuff at a young age, stuff that I was selling, stuff that I could have gone to jail for life for, in the 10th grade. And I was hanging out with this group of friends in school that were just completely crazy. And I thought everybody was doing what we were doing. We were stealing kegs from UCSD, stealing nitrous tanks from UCSD, and we would just like bring them to houses and bring them down to the beach, and it was just wild. There was this one street, it's called Governor Drive, it's in University City, that's where I was, where I grew up, and it was like every day was just a party at some park, and we would all just go and drink and drink and drink and do other substances, and that was my life. And my whole priority from that time until I was 23 when I got sober was staying as drunk as possible and or doing other things. And it was just basically like a blur. I mean, I went to school, and I went down to Mexico on the weekends and got supplies of alcohol in other forms. And I I was 17, 18, I'd go down to Mexico, and I would I would literally take a handful of pills, and I would wash it down with the bottle, and I would drink and drink and drink, and I would black out, and I would, like, I always wanted to go up on stage. Whenever I got drunk, I always wanted to go up on stage. I thought I was, like, this really cool rock star, and so, like, any part of the parties that I went to, like, if there was ever a band, like, I was up on stage singing Brown Eyed Girl with them, and I had this special dance that I would do, and, like, sometimes they thought I was cute and fun, and sometimes they thought I was a total nuisance and, like, 86 me, and it just depended, like, on their mood or what, you know, what party I was at. But I would end up, like, falling off these stages, and I fell down, you know, I was very clumsy because I was mixing different types of alcohol in tablet forms and drinking a lot, and so I would be the girl that would, like, fall down the stairs, and I blacked out a lot, and I would wake up with bruises, you know, all over, and I would say, well, what happened last night, and my friends would recount the stories, and at the time, I thought it was funny. I had no idea that I was so sick and such a shell of a person and so depleted of any morals or any responsibility in life. I wanted to care about my family and my friends. I really did. But my actions did not match up to that at all. My actions were selfish. My actions were, it was all about me. I lied. I cheated. You know, I would screw you over. I would manipulate you. I had gotten to a lot of shoplifting. I did that. I would walk into liquor stores, and I would walk, fill up a shopping cart full of alcohol, and I'd have a big guy next to me, and we'd walk out. And if they came after us, he would take care of whoever came out. You could do that then, 20, I don't know, like 8, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, we did it, and it was crazy. It was absolutely insane. And it, like the book says, that was the only normal life I knew. I did not know that that was completely insane and that that wasn't right. I just didn't have that sense. And since I started using and drinking at 12, I really didn't have a lot of maturity. And what ended up happening was I didn't end up graduating high school. I ended up having a big party at my house when I was 17, and my mom came home, and she kicked me out, and her and my dad said, they said, you know, we really can't have you living with us anymore. They said, but we're going to give you $600, $300 a month each, and go find your own place. And I said, well, that's fantastic, you know. I'll move down to – I said, what a great idea. I was 17. I moved down to Mission Beach, and I was in my last semester of high school, and I decided we had moved up to Del Mar, so I was at Torrey Pines. So I was at one of the nicest high schools in the country, and I had just found, my mom tried to move me away from this Governor Drive, the problem, and she had introduced me to a much wealthier, set of parties and drugs and such. And, so, I was going to Torrey Pines, and I didn't graduate, and I went to the Garfield home study program. And I basically did alcohol in the substance of white powder for about 4 months and program that way. And so I graduated from the home study program. I had my high school diploma, and all I really wanted to do was go to college and, you know, make something of my life. And I had this double life. Like, I wanted to, I loved children, I wanted to work with kids. I had some kind of spiritual, you know, like I wanted to have a relationship with God. I started working with special ed kids, and I wanted to have this good life. And then on the other side of it was this complete crazy partier. I'd be dancing on tables, taking all these drugs and alcohol, in complete bondage of my disease, and I was just getting worse and worse and worse. So I had this double life, like it talks about in the book. And I got this job working with children, with special needs children, and I can remember that I would get so messed up the night before that I would be with them and I would be nodding out, and I would drive them around still drunk from the night before, and I was just really, really, really out of control. So I decided to move to Hawaii, where everything would be better. So I moved to Hawaii when I was 20, and I spent my 21st birthday in Waikiki Beach, and I don't have much recollection of that weekend, but I was in Hawaii, and I was drinking heavily, and I was working, and I was drinking, and I was working, and I was, you know, I was started getting into like kind of a depressed, like a bad place where the alcohol was not working for me anymore. And I ended up staying there about 6 months, and Hawaii wasn't quite close enough to Mexico for me. So I had to come back. And, I mean, really, honestly, I mean, I was a slave to this other substances and absolutely alcohol. I'm an alcoholic to the core, but I did do both a few things, and I had to be close to Mexico so that I could be okay. And I came back, and it just got worse and worse. You know, I was going to school. I was going to I did like the 15-year college program, and I graduated at 5 years sober with my bachelor's. So I went to school for like 7 years before I got, you know, from 18 to 23, or that's not seven, but whatever. Anyway, I'm not good at math right now, but it did take me a really long time to graduate. But I was going to Mesa College, and I would do this thing where I would get really excited, and I would register for like 15 units and this biology and all these classes, you know, neuroscience, and then I would have like 5 withdrawals and a C at the end of the semester. I did that for a couple semesters, and everything just got worse and worse. You know, I lost my apartment. I lost my my car. I got into trouble when I drank. I thought, why do I have such bad luck? And I was always the one that, like, I had so many, I had such legal problems, you know. When I was 18, I got 2 minor possessions of alcohol down in Mission Beach within a month. I had failure to appear, I had driving on suspended license. I would have actually had 4 DUIs, but I only got charged with 2 of them. So I had DUIs. You know, I would always get caught. I was, because obviously I was like so under the influence that if the cops pulled up, I would just, you know, I was the one. And so I was in a lot of legal trouble, and I started like getting kicked out of like Padre games for spilling beers on people in front of me, and they would carry me out, and you know, I just so anyway, I always thought I was okay if I had school, a car, a job, and a place to live. That was my alcoholic thinking. If I have those 4 things, I'm okay. You know, the external. Well, I lost all 4 of those things, And I was dying inside, you know. I was literally like a shell of a person. I had nothing inside. My relationships, with my family and friends were deteriorating and next to gone. I was spiritually bankrupt. I was in pain all the time. The alcohol was not working anymore. And I had a boyfriend who, I was 22, and I had a boyfriend who told me, if I wanted to die like Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and Jim Morrison in my 20s, like I was going, that go ahead and keep going the way that I was going. So I thought, yeah, you know, he's right. I should do something. So I decided to go to a hypnotherapist because, you know, like, because alcohol wasn't the problem. So I thought hypnotherapy would fix me. So I went to this hypnotherapist, and she, this is like so weird with 2 here. For some reason, I told her what was going on. She was like, well, you know, she was trying to have me remember this thing that had happened to me when I was 18, which I blamed all of my problems on. It was this trauma that I thought was the cause of everything. And we were trying to go back and remember it, and I happened to mention to her that I had been doing this, drinking this much and taking this much and these amounts and these, and she said, you need to go to a treatment center, like, immediately. Uh-huh. And this was on a Friday, and by Sunday, I was in a 30-day treatment center. I went to detox. And I got to detox, and there's 2 things I can remember about detox. The first thing that I can remember about detox is they took my intake, and they took a history of how much drugs and alcohol I was taking, and I told them, very honestly, and they said, well, we don't believe you. And I said, well, and they said, you would not be here. You would not be alive mixing these amounts with these combinations with these amount of milligrams with this much alcohol. And I said, well, I don't know what to tell you. Here I am, you know, and that happened. And then I remember the second thing was is that they gave me one of my drugs of choice to come off the detox, which I thought was a great idea. So I'm in detox, and I start sobering up, and I go to a meeting over at the other side at the main recovery home, and I don't know. I just couldn't really relate. I felt like I had maybe jumped the gun. I called my mom and I said, you know, these people, they're very strange. They talk about weird things. They eat cake. They hold hands. They drink lots of coffee and they pray. I said, I'm 22. I'm not a coffee drinker. And I think that we kind of overjumped the gun on this treatment thing, Mom. I said, I think you need to come get me. This is like not the place for me. And she said, well, thanks for sharing, but you're not going anywhere. And I would have left, but I didn't have a lot of options at the time. Like, I didn't have any money or a car or anyone to come pick me up or anything. So I stayed, and I was at that treatment center for 28 days, and I had a couple of things happen to me in that treatment center. I had been consistently on drugs and alcohol for 10 years straight, and my brain was really messed up, and I had gone through detox, and I had gone over to the other side, and I was having really bad panic attacks, and I was having panic attacks around the clock because some second-degree anxiety from some drugs I was coming off of, and because I had never been sober, and because I had an anxiety disorder. So I said to them, first I didn't want to be there. Then I'm way better than this, you know, place, and I can't relate. And then I went to, I'm not sure if you guys are enough help for me. I was like, surely this can't be right, what I was going through in my head. And they said, well, this is normal. They said, what you've been living is not normal. This is you getting normal. And I said, well, sure doesn't feel that way. I said, and I was having, they knew I was having panic attacks, and I would have panic attacks that I was dying. I would have panic attacks that I was disappearing. I would have panic attacks that I was having a heart attack, and they were basically all day. And I finally, and I had a spiritual experience in this recovery home, in this treatment center. I said, God, I said, I can't do this anymore. I said, I can't do the sobriety thing, and I can't drink anymore. And I said, just please, these panic attacks are unbearable. I said, please just don't let me wake up tomorrow. And I woke up the next morning, and the panic attacks were gone. And that was one of the biggest miracles of my life. I experienced the power of God. And there was another time in there, right around that time. It was like I was 2 weeks in there, and I wanted to leave. And I decided I was going to pack up all my stuff, and I was going to walk to the bus stop, you know, and just with my stuff and try to go get some alcohol or whatever. And I was pacing in my room. I was pacing back. I had this little room in the center. I was pacing back and forth. I want to get out of here. I want to get out of here. And I heard this still voice that said, don't go. It said, stay. And I ended up staying in the center, and I ended up coming out and doing the program. I ended up doing the program my own way. I thought that the center had taught me how to drink and control and enjoy my drinking and using. I had a reservation that at a year I would reward myself with a drink. I tried to go back to school. I tried to go back to work. I didn't last in either. And it went straight to jails, institutions, and death for me. I was taking stronger and stronger things. The alcohol was not working. And I had another DUI. I was driving, I would drive in blackouts, and I drove into a parked car in a blackout, which I had done twice. I drove into a car, I was downtown, and I drove into a parked car in a blackout, and neither me or my passenger was wearing their seatbelt. He hit his head on the windshield, and I hit my face into the steering wheel. And I'm so grateful that there was nobody in the cars either of the times I did that. I had a suicide attempt, and I was in an institution, so I was straight at jails, institutions, and death with that relapse. And it was a really, really dark place, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And I took a bunch of pills. They weren't narcotics. I don't know, they're aspirin, everything I could find in the cabinet. And I went to the hospital, and they pumped my stomach, and my parents came, and they saw me there. And I just think about, you know, what that was like for them. And so I said to God, I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I said, I'm going to give this program one last chance. I said, I'm going to do every single thing they say. And I said, if it doesn't work, I'm going to do a Leaving Las Vegas, a Nicolas Cage thing. But I will give it one last chance. I said, I can't live with or without alcohol. You guys will have to excuse me. I'm feeling really... nauseous right now. I think it was something I ate. No, I'm serious. I had chicken McNuggets from McDonald's on the way over here, and oh, they're... Sorry, I'm so sorry about that. That was so inappropriate. But so I completely surrendered myself to the program. I did every single thing that they told me to do. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I was timekeeper at 5 weeks. I was doing H&I at 6 months. I worked the steps diligently with her. I sought God. I was a part of the fellowship. It's like if I heard anything to do at a meeting, I would do it. Yeah, and I didn't think I was going to make it. You know, I did not think that. When I was 13, I remember sitting around with my friends talking about how we didn't want to or think we would live to 30 or 35. And that was just my thoughts about life. And so my first that's my sobriety date, November 9th of 1999. And I went to this recovery home. I too had to go to a sober living. It was very strict, and I won't say what it was called, but there was 20 women and there was one bathroom. And So I ended up here at this county run facility with a trash bag full of clothes, and that was about it. That's all I had, and I just surrendered to this program, and I stayed at that program, and they taught me how to live sober. This program taught me how to live. AA taught me how to live, but at first they had to tell me like when to make my bed and when to eat and when to go to meditation group and when to go to a meeting, and I needed that for several months. And, you know, when I was newly sober, I was really immature, and I didn't know how to live life. I didn't know anything about integrity or anything about responsibility. And, I was so self-centered, and it was like that song, like, "You are always on my mind." Like, it was me, like, "I am always on my mind." Like, the alcoholic song. And I had to, you know, I went through the steps, and I did everything that my sponsor said, and in step one, I didn't have a problem. The really good thing is when I got here, I didn't have a problem with God, and I didn't have a problem with step one. I had believed in God before. I was actually kind of showing up at church, like, loaded, like, not sober and drunk and wondering why I wasn't experiencing what everybody else was, but I went through step one, and I knew my life was unmanageable. That was obvious, and I could agree that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew. I did not have a doubt in my mind. And I went through step two, and I came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And you know, sanity, drinking the way that I was drinking, knowing the consequences, is insane. And part of the insanity is that I can't fix my own problem. I can't keep myself sober. I can't make myself sane. I can't take away my self-centeredness. I can't do anything on my own. I need God for everything. And so I you know, God is either everything or God is nothing. So I came to believe, so it's a process, you know, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and that took a while, but I didn't, you know, obviously wait, because that would have been a while, so I just jumped, obviously, to step three, and I said the third step prayer every day for 30 days, and I tried to pray a lot to God and to surrender my life to Him, as I still do on a daily basis. And sorry, you guys, I'm really not feeling well. So then I went to step four, and I made a list of all the persons that I had resentments against, and it was a really long list. And I had a lot of resentments, and I did the resentment inventory, and I did the fear inventory, and I did the sex inventory, and And I went through all of that with my sponsor, and we did the fifth step together, and I read it all to her, and you know, and we did it out of the book, and when I read it to her, you know, I didn't really feel better right away, like a lot of people talk about. I felt, we burned it, and I kind of felt worse because I felt like I had all this stuff, you know, and it wasn't until I worked through 6 and 7, 8 and 9, 10, 11, 12, that I really started to get some relief. I got some relief from 6 and 7 where I was able to come to God with my defects of character and to just humbly, you know, make a list of them, and they were already included on my 4-step, and ask God to remove which one served him, you know, in his timing. And, you know, it's not like you have the list and you say, God, I humbly ask you to remove them, and then they're all removed, and then you're a spiritual guru. It's, you know, it's like you ask God to remove, and he does with you what he wants in his time. And I made a list of, and I had the list of the amends list, from my 4-step, and I made amends. I had a lot of amends. I had a lot of financial amends. I had a lot of legal amends. The car that I hit, the second time I hit the parked car in the blackout, I hit a car of a woman who had cancer and was doing cancer, treatments. And I had to go to court in early sobriety and face that woman, because I had wrecked her car and her vehicle to get her cancer treatments. I ended up paying her $25 a month for my first 8 years of sobriety. I ended up making financial amends for several years of my sobriety. I ended up donating to a charity and I still do, to make up a lot of the amends, the shoplifting that I can't even remember. Made amends to my parents, you know, just everyone that I had to make amends to, and that's when I first started getting some relief. And then 10, 11, and 12, you know, in pages 84 to 88 of the big book, it outlines step 10 and 11. And, you know, I can't just stop at 9 and then think that I've made my amends. It's like there's these maintenance steps. And, you know, in step 10, I get to take a look at myself, and I get to continue to see where I've been selfish, dishonest, resentful, or fearful. And I get to turn that over to God and continue to grow spiritually, because for me it's about continued spiritual growth, and then also make new amends if I need to make new amends. And then in 11, prayer and meditation, it's one of my favorite steps. I love to pray. Meditation's a little bit hard for me, especially the silent type. Like I'll put on a guided meditation, I'll do that, but sitting silently is hard. I do try to do that, so that I can listen to God, and be still and be present with God. Just kind of let my thoughts pass through. And then 12, you know, is carrying the message and, you know, and having a spiritual awakening is all the steps. And I did, and I had one. And I was able to stay sober, you know, and I had a really good life. I promises started coming true for me. I went back to school. I tried to practice the principles in all my affairs. That I went to this home group in PB, and the meetings taught me how to show up to work, and how to be honest, and how to have integrity, and how to suit up and show up, and how to, no matter what I thought or felt, to continue to take the action. I think that's one of the biggest things that I've done, is no matter how I feel or what I'm thinking, is I continue to take the action. I continue to take the action that the program suggests. I continue to take suggestions. I continue to ask God what to do, my sponsor what to do, and do whatever they say. And so anyway, I ended up going back to school, and, you know, I ended up getting that bachelor's degree at 5 years sober, and I ended up traveling, and I ended up going to Belize, and I ended up, you know, and I have a great relationship with my parents, and I ended up getting, like, all these gifts back, and really having a lot of fun in sobriety, like you were talking about. I learned how to snowboard, I would go on snowboarding trips, and I had, like, a really great time from, like, 2 years to 7 years. It was like I was kind of coasting. And I was working, going to school, and doing my program. Working, going to school, and doing my program. And I went to graduate school in 2005. I got accepted into this graduate school, and I went out to Tucson to do that. And in graduate school, I was still work. I tried to find the program in Tucson and kind of do the meetings out there. And the last like 8 months of graduate school, I decided that I didn't need to do meetings anymore. And I tried this really fun thing called untreated alcoholism. And what I realized later was that this is a three-part program, and it says right here, Unity Service and Recovery, and you know, the recovery part for me is me working my own steps, and I believe in working the steps more than once and every year or every other year, and I wasn't doing that. At this point, I was 7 years sober, and I hadn't done a four-step in like 5 years, and I was sick. So that's me working my steps, me doing inventory, me doing the maintenance steps, stuff like that. Service for me is taking, you can know, 10 minutes, okay. Service for me is, can be setting up meetings or coffee, but primarily the service for me is taking other people through the steps, okay? And giving back what was so freely given to me. And then the third one is the unity, is the meeting. So if I'm doing meetings, I'm doing one part of a three-part program. And I was barely doing meetings. And, you know, there's some people in AA that that can not do a lot of work and be fine, and I'm not that kind of alcoholic. I was talking to a friend of mine, and she was saying that she had 3 years sober, and she was saying that she was doing yoga and running, and she hadn't been to a meeting in a year, and she was doing great. And I was like, well, you know, my hat's off to you. That's not my experience. My experience is that when I'm not working a spiritual program of action, because alcohol is not my problem, alcohol was my solution, and when I get sober and have no spiritual solution, I'm not in a good place. And it's even worse, can be worse than active drinking if I'm dry for too long. And that's what – so I didn't think the thing about being dry for me – is that you don't know you're dry. I'm like, oh, I'm doing great. I don't even need this meetings. You know, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. I was pretty young. And I came back to San Diego, and I was really, really depressed. And I had to have a new experience. I remember even my good friend Nicole, I was kind of just like, I'm just going to do the church. I don't know about AA anymore. I kind of had this jaded thing. It was like my disease was taking over and trying to kill me, you know. I was just kind of like, she was showing me all this cool stuff, and I was like, yeah, you know. And I got to the point where I was at that jumping off point. I was going to take a drink at 8 years sober. I was very depressed and really struggling, and I was going to pick up a drink. And I had to go back through the steps, and I had to do a thorough step one, and I had to look at 8 years sober as if I was an alcoholic. And it was harder at 8 years sober than it was at 1 year sober. And I had to get real with my relationship with God, and that was harder at 8 years sober than it was at 1 year sober. And I had to look at where I had agnosticism in my life, where I was not trusting God if I believed that God was everything or God was nothing. And if I had so much ego at that time that I didn't think I needed God or the program. And I had to take a look at that, and it was really painful stuff. And I had to go back through a four step, which I hadn't worked, like I said, in 5 years. I don't recommend that at all. And I had a longer list than I did when I first got sober, because when I first got sober, I was like, woo, you know, I was resentful, but I was anesthetized. So here there's this 5 years of sobriety, and I have a ton of resentments. And I go back through the four step, and I look deeper into the four step, and I look at really what was affected in all of those categories in the book of self-esteem and pride and pocketbook, and I look at each one of those, and I see the causes and conditions of my alcoholism, and I look at the fears deeper. I look into the fears, and I go, well, why do I have this fear, and why do I have this fear? And I get deeper into the fears, and I get deeper into, you know, the sex inventory, and not only just, oh, who did, you know, this list and this thing, but really what were the underlying things? Where did you hurt people? What is your sexual ideal? And I really went deeper into the steps. And after I did that, I had like a stack, and I worked the steps three times in 4 years. I had to. That's what I had to do to stay sober. And I had the stack of my fourth step. And I just remember I came home in that hour that you come home and review and ask God if there's anything that you missed and do the meditation. And I just literally, physically lifted it up and asked God to take it from me. I lifted it up. And I said, it's all yours, God. I surrender it all to you because I cannot do this myself. And I felt something with that four step as I hadn't the first time I had gone through. And making me amends, like, I went deeper into that. It's like I didn't just make the amends, but I said, you know, is there something I can do to make it right? Is there anything else that I don't know that I've harmed you? You know, a lot of deeper amends with the amends. And then really, really into 10, 11, and 12. 10, 11, and 12. And, okay, so I have 5 minutes left. So the only... So what I want to say is just a couple things is that, you know, the gifts of the program, what my life is like today is that it's so amazing. It's I have fun in sobriety. I just went snowboarding. I think any alcoholic that is going to have long-term sobriety that's not having fun is not going to want to stay sober. And I do that. I continue I have sponsees in my life. My sponsees have been such a blessing. I have relationships with my parents. I have relationships with friends. I have a love in my life. I have a great job. I have a great career. I work in the medical field. And one of the things, a couple things I wanted to say before I close up. One of the things was that when I tried to kill myself in like about 8 months before I got sober, I went to this hospital, and I had the tubes down my throat, and I was in the hospital bed, and I couldn't talk, and I couldn't walk, and I couldn't, get out of bed, and I had mentioned this, that my parents had come, and the despair on their face, and I ended up, after I got my master's degree and ended up working in the medical field, I ended up going to work for that hospital, and I ended up looking in that bed where I was laying, and I was helping people in that hospital, and it was such an amazing feeling of what following the steps and a God of my understanding and the support from the people in this room, these rooms have done for me to go from a place of suicidal hopelessness and complete despair and alcoholism to a place where I have this beautiful, wonderful life and I'm in the, you know, having a career where I'm in the ICU helping other people. And with my parents, you know, I saw my parents had been there and my parents and I just did a lifelong dream. None of us had ever been to Europe, and we all traveled. Me and my parents went to Europe. We went to Turkey, Greece, Barcelona. We went to Spain, Italy, and Monaco in October, and it was the trip of a lifetime. And, you know, that's what I can do today is I can share that with my parents instead of them having to worry about where I am, instead of them having to wonder if I'm going to be alive or dead. Like, they know that tonight I'm, like, at this meeting sharing my story. You know, like, they know that I'm, like, my mom's an alcoholic, so she gets it. But I just called up my dad, and I'm like, I'm going to go tell my life story at this meeting. And he was like, really? And I was like, yeah, you know, he's like, well, yeah, get me the CD, whatever. and then, you know, and just, I have such a great life today. And you know, I just got a house. I got a condo. And when I first got sober, I didn't even think that I would be able to. That wasn't even a goal of mine. But what I want to say really fast, because I know I only have 2 minutes, is I was listening to a song the other day. And the lyric said, what if life's greatest trials are God's blessings in disguise? And it made me remember how much of a disease of perception I have. And when I'm in my own self-pity and thinking I'm going through a trial, what if that's God's blessing in disguise? And how can I change my perception by asking God to change my heart and asking God to change my mind and think differently and be more like God and be more of service and get out of myself? And then the last thing is that today was Founders Day, so it's 77 years, a celebration of AA. And I got this from somebody, I don't know if this was on the handout for it or whatever, but I saw this online and I credit Joe R. for this. And he says, Founders Day, 77 years of miracles. Hope for the hopeless, light from darkness, joy from despair, fellowship from isolation, spiritual awakening from self-absorbed obsession equals gratitude. And that's how I feel today about my sobriety. Thanks for letting me share.